please take their seats? We're going to begin with our speaker cards. Everybody will have 3 minutes each to address the board. And we're still on the Diablo Canyon mitigation agenda item. Let's see. Roger, how do you pronounce John's last name?
Not very well.
Okay.
How about I pronounce it for you?
Olgaretti?
Ugaret.
Ugaret, okay.
Thank you.
I apologize.
That's
that.
Quite all right. It's a tough one. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is John Ugaretz. I am the Nearshore Ecosystem Coordinator and Central Region Manager for the Department of Fish and Game's Marine Region. I am also the department's lead on the Marine Life Protection Act implementation process. And I've prepared some statements. First, I'd like to say that a couple comments about what's going on earlier today and some of the things I've heard. In particular, it's a little unclear at this point as to whether the recent staff report and the discussions today are discussing addressing past impacts or whether this mitigation recommendation is being used for addressing the new 316B regulations or both. If it is both, the department would like to know the timing regarding the new MPDES permit and when PG&E will be required to submit their proposal for information collection as well as their comprehensive demonstration study. It is my understanding that the current effort is only to address past and ongoing impacts, not to address the new reduction requirements in the new 316B regulations. So that's something that we may need to talk to staff a little bit more about later. Regarding a comment that the water taken is returned, that's absolutely correct. However, the living resources in that water are not returned to the environment. There's a clear impact to living resources in California through the intake and processing of water through Diablo Canyon. And also, fishermen are charged. You were correct in stating that commercial fishermen do pay landing taxes on the fish they take, as well as permit fees, and recreational fishermen do pay licensing fees to the department. As a little bit of history, on August 1st, 2004, the department provided written comments on the May 2004 staff report to the regional board, clearly stating our opposition to implementing new MPAs as the primary mitigation measure to address Diablo Canyon's impingement and entrainment impacts. Our comment letter included several alternative mitigation proposals with a focus on establishing artificial reefs and funding for abalone restoration projects, as were included in the original, the abalone was included in the original consent decree. The department appreciates the additional information on artificial reefs that has been developed since that time. The department attended the technical working group's meeting in February of 2005 and again expressed our support for the use of artificial reefs as a potential mitigation option and provided additional comment on the potential for abalone enhancement. On April 13, 2005, the department provided additional written comments to the regional board, reiterating our concerns about the use of MPAs as mitigation for cooling water system impacts. We also provided a more detailed proposal for abalone enhancement at that time. Based on the most recent version of the independent scientist report and regional staff report, we're concerned that the independent scientist may not have seen or fully understood the new proposal for abalone enhancement. And I will discuss that further in a moment. Is my time up?
Time's up. Go ahead.
Thank you.
The vice chair has spoken.
Thank you. MPAs are recognized as a means to preserve and conserve biodiversity, protect threatened, endangered, or overfished species, and provide areas free from human extractive activities to conduct research, and for their potential use as indicators with which to gauge the relative effects of fish population from natural versus anthropogenic impacts. In this regard, MPAs could serve as one aspect of an overall Diablo Canyon mitigation package, in particular if this comes in the form of additional funding for enforcement and monitoring. However, care must be taken into this approach and how it is implemented. Some people consider MPAs as one method to replace resources lost through entrenchment and impingement in the cooling water system or thermal discharges of that system. The department is on record stating that this form of mitigation is inappropriate as a replacement for the impacts caused by Diablo Canyon. While long-term impacts of an MPA will likely include increased abundance and reproductive capacity of fish species, in the short term, this would further increase the area where extractive uses are prohibited, and therefore, in the short term, further impact fishermen trying to catch those species. Perhaps more importantly, while MPAs will likely increase the abundance of fish species, unfished species such as the clinid kelp fishes, gobies, and sculpins, as well as pelagic species like sardines and anchovies, will not necessarily increase in abundance. A large proportion of Diablo Canyon's entrainment impacts are on these unfished species or pelagic species. Increase in abundance in artificial reefs, however, would increase available habitat and reproductive capacity for all species that inhabit those reefs, not just the fish species. MPAs have been established for a variety of reasons in California, but never as mitigation for direct or indirect impacts caused by power plants and using seawater for cooling. The department is concerned that using MPAs in this manner could set a dangerous precedent that has coast-wide implications relative to other existing and potential future power plants or other projects capable of significantly impacting marine resources. Finally, neither the regional board nor PG&E have authority to establish MPAs in California. The state is currently engaged in a detailed public process to consider all types of MPAs along the Central Coast. Proposals from this process will be brought to the Fish and Game Commission in March of 2006 for potential approval in November of 2006. As noted above, while funding to help enforce and monitor new MPAs are welcomed, this should not be the primary form of mitigation for Diablo Canyon's cooling system impacts. I'd also note that the current version of the scientist's reports mentions discussions with the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation regarding a potential process in the Central Coast. I'd like to reiterate, and I think staff is aware, that this process is underway through a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Fish and Game, the Resources Agency, and Resources Legacy Fund Foundation. I would hate to see another process begin with that same foundation in this same area. The staff report states that the scientists do not recommend one form of mitigation above another. While this is true, according to the independent scientist report, artificial reefs would provide the most direct compensation for entrainment losses. Though this is not a recommendation of one method over the other, it is a clear statement of which provides the most direct compensation and therefore the most direct mitigation. The scientists, I believe, are fulfilling their role by not making a recommendation to you on one method over another, as that is a policy decision at the discretion of this board. The department agrees with the finding that they provide the most direct compensation and recommends the use of artificial reefs as the primary form of mitigation for these impacts. While the independent scientist report also indicates that MPAs might mitigate for intertidal thermal impacts, these benefits would likely only occur in areas where intertidal species are currently subject to take. There are other ways to mitigate for the intertidal impacts that might be more beneficial to reduce trampling and reduce impacts from visitor presence in intertidal areas.
How?
You could alter the routes people take. You could have increased docent programs to let people know what not to touch, things like that, enforcement-type mitigations. According to the original draft consent decree, PG&E is required to contribute to abalone restoration, and the department still feels that abalone restoration is a viable alternative for thermal impact mitigation. As noted above, we're concerned that the independent scientists have not fully understood our current proposal, which is not a proposal for establishing disease-resistant stocks, but it is a proposal for the culture and outplanting of post-competent larvae of abalone species, as well as larger adult abalone in the area. And we're happy to continue to work with the technical working group as a member and the independent scientist to provide more information on that alternative. And we do believe that the artificial reef alternative has some very good scientific ability beyond mitigation, in that we can study certain types of artificial reefs in the area for more information. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the board.
Well, I'm curious whether the department then has any sense for what size of an artificial reef would be appropriate to to offset the impacts caused by entrainment?
I believe the estimations in the scientist's report are fair, and the range they give is a broad one. And something within that range would be an acceptable measure to mitigate for the numbers of species lost.
Okay. We heard from the folks from PG&E that they felt that perhaps those ranges were overstated by a magnitude of 6 or 7 times or something like that.
I would question some of their information, and I'm glad to hear that some peer review of the economic survey will be done. I strongly recommend that a separate economic survey be completed if there are funds available to do that. There was a statement made by the PG&E representatives that non-use value is normally restricted to unique resources. I would disagree with that statement. I think there are many beach valuation studies in California that have been done that show incredible non-use value of the existence of beaches and other types of natural areas that are very non-unique, that are very common areas. And I think non-use value is regularly transmitted to areas that are quite common.
Does your department have an economist on staff that is very familiar with these resource valuation methods?
Not. We have one economist in the marine region who deals primarily with some of our regulatory packages. I don't believe, however, I am certainly willing to look into whether he could review the package proposed by TER and make some comments on it. He would not have the time or resources available to complete an independent study.
But does he have the expertise?
Certainly to comment on it.
To comment on it?
Certainly to comment, yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the board? Dr. Valker.
Just a background question. These marine protected areas, how big are they? I mean, how much?
Existing areas?
Yeah. I mean, give a size.
Existing areas in California are incredibly small. That's one of the reasons that the Marine Life Protection Act was passed. On average, I would say they are less than 1 nautical mile square. Very small.
And so the marine protected areas are going to increase the acreage or area of these marine,
The Marine Life Protection Act is a statute that requires that the department review the existing array of areas, improve upon them, and ensure that they function to the extent possible as a network. The likely outcome is that there will be some increase in area. We're unsure at this point what that outcome will be, as we are in the middle of a public participation process that includes scientific recommendations, and we'll know much better as to what the outcome will be in March.
Okay.
Great. Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit more about performance monitoring and the current projected source of funds and support for this, and any of the other important elements of this? Because my understanding is that assuring that the MPA plan or MLPA plan and the strategy for the network and really understanding the improvements over time is something that isn't necessarily in place at this point and is probably a high hurdle for the department.
Correct. And I would say first that monitoring of the effects of marine protected areas is a critical part of the Marine Life Protection Act process, and along with any recommendation, there will be a detailed monitoring plan. With regards to where funds for that monitoring will come from at this point, I'd say we don't know. One of the portions of the Memorandum of Understanding with Resources Legacy Fund Foundation requires that a Blue Ribbon Task Force that has been impaneled by the Resources Secretary provide recommendations on long-term funding by December of this year. They are working on that right now. And as I noted, as a portion of a mitigation package, funding for enforcement and monitoring of marine protected areas would be welcome.
Do you have any sense of what those projected costs look like?
It's difficult to determine because we don't know what the network of marine protected areas will look like. I can provide some ballparks based on Channel Islands experience, where we do have a comprehensive monitoring program. I don't have those off the top of my head. They're large, and given the requirements in Marine Life Protection Act and likelihood of significant changes to the existing array of MPAs, I'd say that they would not be minimal.
Mr. Shawcross.
Yeah, just to follow up on that same issue, I know the administration has just appointed Secretary Chrisman of the Resources Department to head up I forget what they're called, an ocean policy group, and I know one of their main concerns is things they're looking in is the funding for the MLPA. So between them and the Blue Ribbon Commission.
There should be some good recommendations. However, I don't know that those recommendations will come along with dollars, that they will be recommendations on how to do it. The process to find the money will still be there.
Well, a recommendation never comes with dollars. Right. It's just a recommendation on how to get dollars.
I would note that the department is on record at this point of saying that, as you are well aware, we are in very poor financial states. We're 25% reductions in staff over the past several years. We do not intend to ask the Fish and Game Commission to implement anything that we cannot adequately monitor and enforce.
So you're going to need the money up front?
The money will have to be there before implementation.
So if there's no money up front, DFG won't.
We may still make recommendations on the design of a network of MPAs. We would recommend along with it an implementation date.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Briggs.
I might have missed it, but it seemed to me that you said that you agreed with the independent scientist's conclusions in terms of the better nexus or compensatory aspects of the artificial reefs, but I didn't hear you say what you thought of their conclusions about marine protected areas being better in terms of overall marine environmental protection.
I would agree with the scientists' conclusions regarding the value of marine protected areas to the ecology of California's ocean environment. We do not agree with the use of new marine protected areas as a mitigation for cooling water impacts.
Okay.
I can't be more clear than that.
Mm-hmm. So that's a policy?
Yes.
Kind of, instead of based
yes.
on science?
Again, it's one, the nature of the impacts to the environment go beyond fish species, and marine protected areas, while we are certain they will increase the abundance of fish species and reproductive capacity of fish species, they may not address impacts to unfished species. And secondarily, this concept that if your intent is to mitigate for a loss in fishing opportunity for the fish species, and your resulting mitigation option further reduces fishing opportunity in the short term, that may not be the best way to mitigate.
Isn't the overall goal of marine protected areas to improve the fishery, though?
In the long term, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the goals, I should say. The primary goal in the Marine Life Protection Act is about ecosystem biodiversity and natural having natural resources available, not necessarily just for fishing.
Okay.
Michael.
Isn't the goal of the MPA to preserve all types of marine habitats, not just a specific type?
Yes.
So
yes.
Sandy bottom, rocky habitat, intertidal habitat.
The Act mentions specifically a variety of habitats and in several places discusses the need to replicate both representative and unique habitats in marine protected areas. So it isn't just rocky habitats it's addressing.
Right, so all marine
all
habitats.
All habitats, yeah.
And when you say that reefs would be the better mitigation, you're talking in the sense literally of compensation, where reefs would compensate for entrainment losses.
Correct.
More directly.
Yes, just as the scientists have stated it. And
right.
And we feel that if you're, in our opinion, as a policy decision, that is a better decision.
Okay, that's a better decision.
Yeah.
But there's the other issue there that I've been trying to bring into the picture is that there's another question, and that's which option is better for the marine environment overall. Right? Do you understand that?
Well, yes, I understand that question. I'm not sure that is the charge. I understand that, and I certainly agree that is a valuable thing to consider. Mm-hmm. However, if you're talking about direct impacts to the environment of an activity, I think something better linked, something linked to compensating for those direct impacts is more appropriate.
Yes, I'm questioning whether we should be trying to replace the things that are in train as a policy. Like you said, you're not sure if that's the charge. I agree. I'm not sure if that's the charge. Mm-hmm. And so that's the question I'm bringing up, is that we could spend tens of millions of dollars creating a few hundred acres of reef, and in an attempt, that would be in an attempt to replace some of the things that are entrain. We could not replace all of the things that are entrain. It's only a portion of them. And so the question is, maybe there's something else we can do that is better for the overall marine environment than putting tens of millions of dollars into a couple of hundred acres of habitat.
I would actually disagree and say that you have a better likelihood of replacing more of the types of species that are entrained through the use of artificial reefs because of the fact that marine protected areas will certainly increase fish species abundance and fish species, but not necessarily unfished species.
I agree. Yeah. There's no disagreement here. The artificial reefs would replace more of the species that are entrained than would reserves. The artificial reefs would compensate for more of the entrained species, more of the entrained losses. Absolutely true. I'm saying I'm not sure that's the best thing to do for the marine environment over the long term. It's literally to put more rocks into the ocean. Sure. I'm not sure that's the best thing to do.
And I would say that, you know, obviously the department's charge is broader than managing impacts of Diablo Canyon, and we are engaged in a process to review and improve upon California's marine protected areas, and we are taking that charge very seriously. I think the ecosystem type of management that we are undertaking in that process is appropriate and is valuable to California. Again, I'm focusing these comments on mitigations for Diablo Canyon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dr. Hunter, last one.
Thank you. On the abalone enhancement program, can you just give us a few more details on the scale?
The new program, cost-wise, the approximate cost to study and culture black abalone would be about $3.75 million over 14 years. That would include 7 years of initial study and initial culture to parameterize actually raising black abalone. There has not been success in captive rearing of black abalone. And then an additional $2.1 million over 7 years for the culture and outplanting of red abalone. Those are broad estimates. I'm not giving exact numbers here. But red abalone we know we can raise. And the big question that would be studied initially is the effectiveness of post-competent larval outplanting, which has not been done in California. There have been some studies done in Australia that have been quite successful. This is different than taking large abalone out and sticking them on rocks. We're talking about just after the larval stages. And the reason for this is, one, you can get a lot more abalone outplanted that way. You can outplant thousands as opposed to hundreds at a much lower cost. Also, there is some indication from our earlier attempts to outplant abalone in California that outplanting large adult abalone is not terribly effective, and that in some cases even it appears that abalone raised to adulthood in captivity may not have the appropriate behavior strategies to survive in the wild.
Abalones have behavior?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have one more question? I'm sorry.
I did have one. Go. Oh, just one quick statement, and this goes to what Michael was saying.
Okay.
I think if we're looking at the reef versus putting money into a reef versus the MPA the MLPA process, I think if you take an amount of money and put it into a reef, you've got a reef. If you take that same amount of money and put it into, say, monitoring and enforcement in the MLPA process, that's not going to change the process at all. They're still going to come up with whatever marine protected areas that they decide on, regardless of whether, you know, they get any money out of this deal or not. So we're going to have no effect in that at all. It's going to be what it is. We're not going to create more marine protected areas because we have whatever the number is, 10 million, 26 million, to put into that process. We're not going to create one more marine protected area because the process is the process and it's going on. But if we do a reef, then we got a reef.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make that.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to our next speaker, Marla Bruton, then Pamela Hetherington, and then David Nelson. Are they here? Marla? Okay, that was agenda item 15.
Pam Hetherington.
Okay. Ms. Hetherington? Roger, I'll give that back to you. Then after David Nelson is Henrietta Groot.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and members of the board. My name is Pam Hetherington, and today I'm representing two organizations, the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo and the Surfrider Foundation, San Luis Bay Chapter. And I'd like to refer you back to a joint letter that we issued on July 1st, 2004, with the World Wildlife Fund, the Ocean Conservancy, and the Sierra Club, having to do with comments about the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant consent judgment, which is the predication for the funding that you're discussing today. We do have definite issues with this. The consent judgment is neither within the public interest nor legally enforceable. The regional board cannot legally prescribe a right to pollute indefinitely. And by doing this, having this discussion, you're granting PG&E an NPDES permit ad infinitum. You know, you're going to settle for past harm done to the marine ecosystem, future harm done. So what's their incentive to improve any processes that they have on their land right now? The consent judgment fails to consider the federal draft Phase 2 regulation for best available technology. And I know Michael has gone to great extent in the staff report to say that there's no best available technology that is financially feasible. Well, you know, you're talking a large ocean. You're talking a lot of impacts with impingement and entrainment. We're talking about minimal amounts of money, according to what their economic valuation fellow said. So we're not looking at a whole lot of money to sustain anything, let alone a reef or an MPA process. So I think that, you know, revisiting this consent judgment with realistic figures for this ecosystem devastation is reasonable to ask for. The consent judgment also fails to equitably compensate the people of California, and I think we've heard that from Mr. Ugaritz, and we've heard it from Dr. Raimondi as well, that some of these impacts are not calculable. And we haven't even started to talk about what Dr. Hunter said about cumulative impacts. Now, granted, Morro Bay isn't at full capacity, and we hope that it never will be again, but it does compromise whatever valuation you're going to put on Diablo, because that historically has done impingement and entrainment damage over time. So I'll close by saying that, you know, I asked Dr. Raimondi before you reconvened about SONG setting a standard as far as having the reef put out there before any 316 rules were in effect. And, you know, certain circumstances could bring it under the Coastal Commission under a CEQA evaluation. It would be having to do with changing the nexus of the plant, I've been told. But I still hold out in the environmental community that what you need to do is look at Diablo Canyon as a whole in an ecosystem that is going to continually impact. And until you do something about the impingement and entrainment, we're going to be doing this into the future and to future generations. Thank you.
Thank you. David Nelson, then Henrietta Groot.
Hi, I'm David Nelson. Thank you for allowing me to address the board. My concerns were addressed by a couple of the board members. I'm glad to say that one is, you know, the value of the water. You guys are being put in a position that's almost impossible. You have about 14 different lawsuits going on the new regulations that you're being asked to interpret now to issue these permits, and it's almost impossible. But something needs to be done, and I think another economic view of this situation needs to be brought to light. We're talking about the coldness of our water being taken out of Diablo Cove, turned into energy, and sold. That's what we're doing. What's going on here and why I believe that the lawsuits are really valid is that in doing what we're doing here, you're allowing the polluters just to write a check by saying, gee whiz, it's going to cost me $1 billion to build a dry cooling system out there. Well, in Las Vegas, they spend over $1 billion on a hotel, so what is a lot of money? We're talking about effects on the ocean that can't be determined. We're talking about counting 15 of the hundreds of different things that are in this food chain, and I use the word food chain as being part of that food chain because I eat the fish that comes from there that our fishermen catch. Now, you're talking about marine reserves. Now, what you're talking about there is taking the burden off of PG&E and putting it on a very small fishing community that goes out there to feed us from this food chain. So they get to kill the bottom of the food chain, and I don't get to eat the top of the food chain, and they benefit. So in those areas, you really have to come to light with what the value of this is. And the idea of the new regulations is to stop people from using once-through cooling because everybody knows it's a terrible system, and there's better ways to do it. We've submitted plans from Europe for dry cooling for nuclear power plants. It can be done. You know, it's just too easy for corporations to say, gee, it costs a lot of money. Well, you know, I just say that most of the new power plants that are coming online are dry cooled, and it does cost money, but so does what they're doing, and we don't get to calculate the damage that they do, and nobody pays for it, but we all pay for it in a really big way, and it's a really serious situation. And you people have a jurisdiction over three major drawers of water in estuaries that can't be replaced. And the cumulative part of this argument is that don't look at Diablo Cove as an ocean. Look at it as a river, because when their buoy broke loose, it ended up over in Cayucos. That's because there's a stream that goes down there. And any surfer that surfs out there can tell you about the stream from Morro Bay to Diablo, and there's a connection, and you got to figure it out. Thank you.
Thank you. No, you bring up a good point to add to what John had said earlier. It's not just the value of the living resource, but there is the value of the cold water, which is being changed to a temperature which is not conducive for organisms to live in when it's discharged again. That's the thermal impact.
Well, the big thing about that is a energy, that's an efficiency boost to a private company that's producing energy. That gives them an edge over the people that have to use dry cooling inland. So it discourages dry cooling as long as you allow this to continue. And I know Diablo is one of those cases that are hard to say, well, do dry cooling, because for many reasons. But other plants in the area can use dry cooling, and they have to use dry cooling. But as long as they can just write a check for less money than it's worth to use the water, it's the cost of doing business. It's like, you know, if somebody's marketing a product that's not safe, but they know it's only going to cost them X and they're making double X to leave it out there, they're going to do that. And it's the same case. Thank you.
Well, that's the complexity with this issue and what we're dealing with. If we were starting from scratch, that'd be one thing, but we're not.
This is probably one of the most knowledgeable boards I've ever seen in this county, and I hope that you can come to grips with it with the help of everybody out here. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Henrietta Groot.
Good afternoon. My name is Henrietta Groot. I'm a member of the board of the Coastal Alliance on Plant Expansion. A couple of things I want to call to your attention. The CEC staff, that's the California Energy Commission, in June of this year published a very important report on issues and environmental impacts associated with once-through cooling at California's coastal power plants. Basically, the report came out against once-through cooling and recommended alternative cooling methods, if at all possible, because of the impacts on marine life. I have a hard copy here for you, which will give the references. Next, Dr. Raimondi quite properly pointed out that there are many impacts that have gone unstudied. And I would like to, and basically what you are considering today in your labors is values. What values do you apply? And I would like to broaden that picture even by citing information from a recent CEC workshop on nuclear power in California. And that transcript is online. That was in Sacramento in August 15 and 16. Very many interesting items there. Question, do we need the power from Diablo? People often say that as a reason that we should go easy on Diablo. Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute says that nuclear power can be replaced by conservation, renewables, and cogeneration if we stop subsidizing nuclear plants. And I understand there's an interesting article by him on energy efficiency in the September 2005 Scientific American. Now, what happens? Next question. What happens to the spent fuel generated at Diablo? Bob Lou, of the state of Nevada made it quite clear that the Yucca Mountain proposal is so defective that it will never happen. In other words, the spent fuel that is generated there for whatever period of time will need to stay at Diablo in perpetuity. Transportation, it was discussed, is another lousy option with great hazards. Next question, is nuclear power really clean? Many people claim that these days. It's not clean if you take into account radiological emissions and the heat generated by the power plant. And of course the heat is what comes out in the thermal exhaust. And heat is very important if we're talking about global warming scenario.
Okay. Thank you very much. Your time's up.
There's a couple more points I wanted to make, but I'll let you leave you.
Mr. Groot, I appreciate your interest in everything, but you're addressing things that are beyond this board's jurisdiction. It would be more helpful to us, and I know that you can do so, to kind of stick to what we're grappling with at the moment. And so we can't deal with these other issues. We don't have power to. Just beyond us.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of that. That was one of the things I was going to say. All I'm trying to do is give you the broader picture. In other words, the decisions that you make about marine life affect a great deal more than just the marine life.
Well, and I appreciate that. And believe me, we're all very aware of that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have the heart.
April Wakeman, followed by Robert Osborne, and then Steve Rebuck.
May Mr. Osborne and I exchange?
Sure. And you are?
April Wakeman.
April, okay. So, Mr. Osborne? And so, Ms. Wakeman, you are not going to address the board?
Afterward,
okay.
Thank you.
And then Mr. Rebuck.
My name is Robert Osborne. I'm a fishery consultant for United Anglers of Southern California. We're an organization of recreational anglers that have 6,000 members and about 50,000 affiliated recreational members in California. We're active in numerous areas, including enhancement of marine resources, artificial reefs, hatcheries, grew out pens. We also are active in conservation with fishery management, including marine protected areas. We sponsor educational programs related to marine resources and their uses. California marine anglers are the primary mover for the management and protection of marine species and environments in California. We contribute through license fees and federal excise taxes on fishing equipment, $28 million per year, more than the entire marine region budget. UASC supplements these efforts through the use of volunteers and donations from private citizens interested in having healthy and vibrant fisheries for generations to come. We are not opposed to marine reserves and see marine reserves as a tool in the toolbox for achieving the objectives of recreational anglers. However, marine reserve use needs to be carefully balanced with other management techniques to have any hope of providing net benefits to the citizens of California. I have a bit of bone to pick with some of the language in the documents. It deals with a comment regarding ecological value being the equivalent of non-use value. Secondly, there is a comment that the creation of marine reserves is likely to provide greater and longer-term value to the marine environment. We view these comments to be terribly overreaching. First of all, listening to all the presentations here, I was struck by the inference that non-use values incorporate all non-consumptive activities. It simply is not true. While I agree with the presentation on non-use values, I couldn't help but notice that a great deal of value was dependent upon having resources available was missing in his presentation. I also had problems with how limitedly characterized recreational fishing values and to some extent also commercial fishing values. Also absent were valuations in non-consumptive use such as diving. Specifically, by way of example, the travel method for valuing recreational fishing makes an implicit assumption that a recreational angler will simply move further up or down the coast and partake of the limitless resources available there. That's an unrealistic assumption. Also, not included in the analysis are tremendous amounts of producer surplus in support industries dependent upon fishing, including tackle, bait, charters, housing, and boats. For the state of California, the American Sport Fishing Association estimated the California anglers spend $2 billion annually in pursuit of their sport. By the mile, that equates to about $2 million a mile. Doing a quick and dirty analysis of 10% is lost for 40 miles, that's $8 million.
Mr. Osborne, could you wrap it up, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
On another note, cost is, in fact, often an indicator of value. It is one of the three methods mandated by an appraisal associations for good evaluation studies. However, cost needs to be considered in view of the other methodologies, which include the market approach and the income approach. Via the market approach, artificial reefs are often at least equal to their costs because, darn it, people build them. The income approach is essentially what the presentation was giving us, but these values need to converge. United Anglers attorney April Wakeman will address some other issues. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak and like you to know that recreational anglers stand ready to assist you with this difficult and important issue.
Thank you. So, Mr. Osborne, any sense for one form or another, artificial reefs over MPAs or vice versa? What's the sense of your organization?
Actually, Ms. Wakeman is going to address that very subject.
All right, good.
Good afternoon. My name is April Wakeman. I'm the attorney for United Anglers of Southern California. Bob has explained, and I'll very quickly hit on why recreational anglers need to consider our position. The nexus of mitigation should go to the harm. Entrainment reduces fish. Reserves in California reduce our ability to fish, so recreational anglers are getting hit with a double whammy here. We like to fish, and we need fish there. One of my pet peeves is in the MLPA process is, unfortunately, the term marine protected area and reserve is used interchangeably. They are not. Georges Bank on the East Coast is seen as the greatest example of where reserves work. Georges Bank, unfortunately, would not be considered a reserve in California. The MLPA provides three different types of marine protected areas, and I submit that perhaps by expanding, looking at more than just reserves, look at conservation areas and marine parks also gives you a wider range of options, and then we use the language correctly. Finally, economics. We fishermen do contribute. The Central Coast is a great place to fish. When the Channel Islands were closed or, in effect, made reserves, the effects on not only the fishing tackle, the landings, the boats, restaurants, gas stations, motels, was three times the effect noted. If the fish aren't there, we can't catch them. I'm more interested in having fish out there than just about anybody else. Maybe because I'm not a good fisherman, I don't know. But we need fish out there. We support the process. We need a vibrant, good marine environment. But you need to take into account the socioeconomic values. And, God, you guys have a tough job.
What about artificial reefs, artificial habitats? You didn't comment on that.
Artificial reefs would be great. I support my friend John Ugaretz here. John and I don't always agree on the MLPA process. Perhaps building an artificial reef as a reserve would create a great chance to see whether they work or not in California and what happens. We just don't want more of our fishing taken away from us unless we're going to see that there's a real benefit. And I guess we support the DFG process on the MLPA because what they're doing is taking everything into consideration to create a network that works together as opposed to a piecemeal process, which we've had so far.
Okay, a question for you. In doing an artificial reef format, we would be essentially taking a piece of water bottom that's currently in some type of production and converting it.
Correct.
Is your group concerned about that, that whatever extractive resources going on in that area is going to be converted?
You know, sometimes we have to give up fishing for the better good. We just want to make sure that the pieces are all considered, that a decision isn't made accidentally, that I may be shot by some of my constituents, but we support reserves in the proper place, designed properly. We just think that we need to design them properly and not just say, oh, reserves sound like a good idea. And unfortunately, equating entrainment with reserves is tough for us. Some reserves may be proper.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Ms. Wakeman, is it true that fishermen, both recreational and commercial fishermen, would very much want to see research done, monitoring done, performance monitoring done, if the reserves are established, if the three categories of MPAs are established, that is essential to oversee those areas and do the monitoring to see whether they're effective or not?
Not only is it essential, it's legally necessary.
Okay. So what if they're established, but there isn't any money to do that?
Then we're in trouble because if they're established without monitoring, then we're in violation of the law. The MLPA specifically provides, and that's one of the reasons why recreational fishermen are supporting the process, because the MLPA provides for adaptive management that says, let's try a reserve, let's see if it works. Maybe it should be bigger, maybe it should be smaller.
That's where I was going with this.
That's very important.
That's the foundation of an adaptive management program.
Exactly.
Is to check to see whether what you're doing is effective.
Correct.
So sometimes the way the state does things is they'll go ahead and make a decision. They won't monitor whether it's effective or not, but that decision will stand over time.
Unfortunately,
right.
Yes.
So where I'm going with that is what we are what we are proposing, at least on a staff level, what we are proposing is that funding to support these reserves, if they are adopted by the commission, to set an endowment aside that would fund those over the long term, would provide what you are seeking here, that long-term management, adaptive management process that includes performance monitoring.
I guess where you and I would differ is I would ask you, instead of using the word reserves, to use marine protected area, so that you could examine conservation areas and parks also, not just reserves.
Right, various degrees of use.
Exactly.
Right.
And then we're in total agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh.
Dr. Hunter.
Wakeman.
Ms. Wakeman.
I just want to be clear. You're supporting reserves, an artificial reef as a reserve?
God, no. Help me.
That's what I thought I heard you say.
Yeah. We support the MLPA process, which would include reserves as well as conservation areas and parks, designed as a network to work together. We think that the state, because we think it has to be done on a statewide basis, the state needs to control that process.
I guess what I'm really talking about the decision we're making. I think Chairman Young asked you what your view was in terms of the choices we have.
Okay.
And in terms of an artificial reef, are you supporting an artificial reef as a no-take reserve, or are you advocating that we consider?
Sure.
Thank you.
April's been with us for a short period of time. She's not real familiar with some of the artificial reef programs that we've been participating in. We strongly support artificial reefs as a means of mitigation. We think that they're very effective. The artificial reef programs we've been involved with have done better than we expected them. In fact, on a one-for-one basis against natural reefs, they seem to do a better job when they're well-designed. It's just like the concept of how do populations accumulate in the city? Artificial housing.
Better than the savannah. I agree. Okay. Mr. Reebuck, followed by Don Canestro, and then Tom Laurie.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the board. My name is Steve Reebuck. For 20 years, I worked for the Commercial Abalone Association, commercial divers in Santa Barbara and statewide. I also served for a couple years or attended the meetings of your technical working group and take some responsibility for the $350,000 that was budgeted for black abalone research. Besides just outplanting abalone, I think that something that would be really important to know is why does warm water contribute to withering syndrome? It appears to be one of the vectors for spreading disease. When the disease showed up in 1988, it actually made a leap from down around Point Arguello area, so covered quite a lot of coastline in a short amount of time. The black abalone, though, is not the only abalone of concern. Haliotis simulus, the threaded variety, is probably the most rare in California. Used to be very common down around Pecho Rock, and that population has declined over time. Now, I've been working with the Department of Fish and Game and the Fish and Game Commission on their draft abalone recovery management plan. To me, recovery indicates an endangered situation, that it's a term used in the Endangered Species Act. And so I take that very seriously, that some of these populations and species may be candidates, black abalone for one, and I think it would behoove PG&E to get out in front of this before it actually is dealing with an endangered species. I learned what I heard earlier about the spread now up towards the Big Sur area of withering syndrome. The closure of abalone south of San Francisco actually created a marine protected area that goes all the way from San Francisco now to Mexico, and yet it remains to be seen whether we'll ever have a fishery again. We're negotiating with the department on that right now. And then in regards to reefs, I haven't heard any discussion about species-specific reefs. In Japan, In other countries, reefs are designed for enhancement of particular species. It's not just rubble and junk dumped in the ocean. There's a lot of technology that's already been developed here. I've got some publications on this, so I'd be happy to share them with Mr. Thomas if you like. But designing specific reefs for specific species makes a lot more sense than just dumping rocks out in the ocean. I've dove Point Bichon. You've got reef structure out there that's, you know, a foot or two high and very small, smaller than this podium. And you'll find abalone and other animals living on those reefs. So just to close, I think that those are areas I support a reef rather than an MPA and appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Don Canestro? Is Mr. Canestro here? Okay. How about Tom Laurie? Followed by Edwin Ewing, and then Carolyn Moffett.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Laurie. I live in Morro Bay. The recorded current data at Diablo Canyon is germane to the impact calculations as well as the mitigation, and I had a few comments about the currents. I got interested in current data produced at Diablo Canyon because this data was used at Morro Bay to calculate offshore larval populations susceptible to entrainment at the Morro Bay power plant. According to the model, a brisk alongshore current transports larvae through approximately 50 square kilometer study grid centered at Diablo Canyon. When this current is fast, more larvae are available to be entrained, and therefore the proportional loss of larvae by entrainment is smaller. To labor this point, more current means more calculated, lower calculated entrainment impacts. Less current means higher calculated entrainment impacts. I plotted several evolutions of the 37,000 line data series taken at Diablo Canyon between 1995 and 1999. Two very important defects in PG&E's current analysis are apparent. Number one defect is that the Diablo Canyon longshore current contains a strong tidal oscillation, which was never factored out of recorded current speeds. This tidal component overstates current velocities at Diablo by a factor of almost two. The overstated longshore current velocities understate entrainment impacts. Instead of simply passing through the study grid, small cohorts of larvae slosh back and forth in front of the plant as the tide changes. The onshore current, this is the second defect, is that the onshore current at Diablo used to calculate larval densities of subtidal and offshore fish appears to be entirely man-made. During the study period from April 1977 to June 1999, the only time this current flowed offshore was during stages when half the plant was shut down. Now, the measuring device was a kilometer offshore. The harder PG&E pumps, the swifter the current, the smaller the entrainment impacts. It's the scientific equivalent of the perfect crime. It's extremely important for the credibility of Diablo's 316B that these defects be addressed. Both the calculated impacts and the proposed mitigation depend on a correct analysis of the currents. I will submit a detailed paper to Mr. Briggs next week. Thanks.
Thank you. Edwin Ewing and then Carolyn Moffett.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Ewing, and I was asked by the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association to stop by and speak on their behalf. And as it stands right now, I believe that most commercial fishermen in our association would be against putting money towards an MPA. And they would probably support, and they wouldn't go against it, at any rate, a reef or abalone research or hatcheries. But there's a specific reason why we would not like the money to go to MPAs. We don't believe that there's any research or enough research to show that they're actually going to work in the way they're presented. They have no baseline data. They have very poor monitoring of their existing marine MPAs that they have now. They're basing their theories on MPAs from the East Coast and other areas where water temperatures are warmer, fish grow faster, different species, different types. So no one knows exactly how this process is going to work. And our biggest problem that we have with the MPAs, to be exact, is that the state passed the law to implement them without the money, and then they took money from a private foundation supplied by the Packard Foundation and other resources. And that money has skewed the process. We believe that they have an undue influence on how the process was brought about. If they had said, okay, here, Fish and Game Commission, here's state, here's some money, go do what you want to do with it, that's not quite how it went. There's some strings attached there. And I'm not sure exactly how the agreement is, but they only gave them part of the money to get the process started. Then if they like how the process is going, they'll give them more. So we're very skeptical about how this MPA process is coming about. And now I don't know, but it sounds, if I want to break it down to simple things, PG&E killed our fish. Well, how much did they kill? Well, we don't know. We're not scientists. But it seems that it would be awful unfair for them to go kill fish and then to say, to correct the problem, we're going to stop fishermen from fishing somewhere else. Another problem with the MPA is if they have too big of MPAs, too large of areas, that the environmental seem to think is going to work great, what's that going to do? It's going to concentrate all the effort from commercial and sport fishing in other smaller areas and put more impact on that. And also, you put an MPA in there, what are you going to do? You're going to create a great big lunchbox for an overpopulation of sea lions that nobody's addressed. And it's not your problem to go into all this stuff. But I'm just telling you, there's more problems with what meets the eye, your eye specifically, in your decisions. And it doesn't sound like you're going to make a decision soon anyway with the lawsuits that are going on with the EPA. But nevertheless, we would still be advised that we would not want you to put the money towards an MPA. Stick with the artificial reef, the abalone hatcheries, fish hatcheries, anything that's going to improve the resources without hurting the fishermen. Thank you.
A question for you. How do you feel with the artificial reef concept, though? What's happening is a portion of Sandy Bottom is being converted.
Whoopie-doo. Well, let me tell you about Sandy Bottom. I'm not trying to be a smartass, but every time you get a big swell in, that sand moves like mad. Its bottom changes immensely. So now if you put a reef in a sandy bottom, let's assume you're in 35 feet of water, and you get an El Nino comes by, you may not have a reef left. It might be covered up. That sand's moving all the time, and so do the species that are in that sand move all the time. We did some studies trawling. Heaven forbid, we were trawlers. And we did video cameras of the trawl doors in the bottom, you know, in the sand. And there's little ripples in the sand about this big. And that's all that the trawl doors did when they went across that sandy bottom, was just smooth out those ripples. We could go back there a month later, and there might be gravel there because the sand moved. Stuff's moving all the time. You're not going to hurt anything putting it in the sand. You might take some area away from somebody that might catch a halibut, but well, it'd be awful small.
No, but that's what I'm referring to.
Because to tell you the truth, you know, there's no gillnetters left, commercial fishing that used to fish for halibut. The trawler's got to stay outside 3 miles. So basically, if you put your reef in state waters in Sandy Bottom, the only person that's going to be maybe displaced would be a hook and line fisherman for halibut, and they got lots of areas to go fish halibut. Your little reef is not going to hurt them.
Okay. Dr. Bowker.
God, I can't go away. I got to go home.
As I understand it, at the present time, there is a 1 mile marine security area, no vessels within Diablo.
That's correct. It's more or less national security. They don't want anybody within
any kind of
a mile radius. So it'd be 2 miles long, a mile out, like that.
So in effect, there's already a marine protected area de facto.
Yep, it is. It's not a no-take zone, but they don't let you go in there and take anything anyway, so it might as well be.
And you wouldn't want to swim in either.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Briggs.
You're a popular guy today. Another question for you. If you accept the notion that MLPAs are going to go through regardless, then why would you care about additional money potentially going towards making them better with implementation and evaluation of them?
Well, first of all, your own scientists said that basically for the smaller species, the pelagic species, the reef's going to help them more. And the reason I don't want the money going to an MPA because I think they're going to restrict both commercial and sport fishing unduly without proper baseline to start with. So if you give this money to them for monitoring, you could, But they're going to do that anyway. If they put these reserves in, they're not going to put a big reserve in that they can't monitor. So no matter what, they're going to monitor what reserves they put in. If you put the money in there, they might put bigger reserves in, and we don't like that either. It's simple.
So you're against
to me,
it?
It's simple.
So you're against it because it might mean more preserve areas.
Of course, because okay. Basically, because it's going to crunch everybody down into a less area and put more pressure on areas that aren't reserves. And I think we have enough regulations as it is now. If they just enforce what they have. Thank you.
Okay, Carolyn Moffitt, our last speaker. If there's anyone else that wishes to address the board on this issue, please get a speaker card and get it up here. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm Carolyn Moffitt, and I'm commissioner at Port San Luis Harbor District. The Harbor District participated on the initial task force assigned to evaluate data and identify the impacts of thermal discharge and entrainment at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, and has participated pretty consistently since then. Today, my comments do not address the reef project, but the combined benefit of the mitigation options that have not been recommended. We urge that the Regional Water Quality Control Board to adopt mitigation measures that demonstrate the tightest and most direct nexus possible to the loss of the biomass caused by the operation of Diablo Canyon. Toward that end, the district recommends the following funding measures be given high priority. Funding marine protected areas specifically and exclusively for the purpose of improving water quality and restoring habitat. Such application of a marine protected area has a direct nexus to the impacts of entrainment and the thermal pollution, and is consistent with the roles and responsibilities of the Regional Water Board. In addition, it is consistent with the Marine Life Protection Act objective to address all impacts to the marine environment. Funding existing watershed, marine-related programs, and pollution control programs managed by organizations in the county of San Luis Obispo, for example, the Morro Bay National Estuary Program and Central Coast Salmon Enhancement are involved in watershed enhancement, education, and marine habitat restoration and protection programs. These organizations lack funds to implement all of their programs, fund other county programs whose operation improves the quality of water running into the ocean, such as stormwater runoff and collection systems. Funding for a rockfish grow-out facility could put thousands of juvenile fish back in the impacted area. This grow-out facility would replenish both sport and commercially caught rockfish lost in the operation of the power plant, as well as provide valuable knowledge in rockfish species grow-out science. And funding to conduct in-depth collaborative surveys and monitoring of the Central Coast rockfish population to provide better stock assessments. State and federal fisheries agencies lack the knowledge or understanding of the near shore of the Central Coast sport and commercial rockfish species population and health. Additionally, the Harbor Commission urges funding for programs and agencies that promote understanding and the appreciation of the value of the marine environment. Such programs have immeasurable long-term benefits, and we support the following of these. Funding for the Marine Interest Group, a grassroots local marine focus group, and funding for educational agencies located in San Luis Obispo County to establish local school programs that focus on the marine environment and habitat protection. Although the regional board staff and consultants may not regard this as an appropriate mitigation, we see the long-term value of these programs and wish to see them enhanced. We appreciate the opportunity to continue to participate in this process as you go forward, and we will make further comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Andrew Christie. Mr. Christie, I did have your card, but it was in the stack with the Pearson ACL, and that's why it didn't pop up.
Things happen.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and board members. I'm Andrew Christie. I'm chapter coordinator for the Sierra Club in San Luis Obispo. and I find myself surprisingly in agreement with PG&E on one point. Wait and see is very sound advice on this matter. I am delivering the following remarks on behalf of the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, Sarah Newkirk, and the Ocean Conservancy. Our purpose in addressing you today is to recommend that you refrain from endorsing mitigation alternatives as a means of complying with Section 316B regulations. The timing of this evaluation could not be worse. EPA's new regulations implementing Section 316B for existing power plants have already been challenged in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Furthermore, the state of California has recently undertaken to develop policy guidance on implementation of 316B and will hold a scoping workshop on furtherance of this objective on September 26th. With both federal and state policy in a state of flux, the regional board would be ill-advised to take any action short of requiring PG&E to upgrade its plant with closed-cycle cooling technology. The Second Circuit has already ruled that mitigation alternatives should not be available to new power plants for compliance with 316B and noted in dicta that no distinction between new and existing structures is made in the law. The very same court is now considering the very same question for existing power plants, and in light of this dicta, it is highly unlikely that the mitigation alternative will survive review. The board should not waste additional time and money exploring mitigation options that most likely will not exist next year. That said, you don't have to bet on the outcome of the Second Circuit litigation to know that staff's mitigation recommendation is not legally viable. Even under 316B as written, long-term funding for the MLPA process will not provide mitigation that meets the regulation's requirements. The recommended alternative would simply fund an ongoing state process that may potentially result in marine reserves of unknown size and location. There has been no and can be no quantitative demonstration required by the regulations that the MLPA process will replace fish or replace fish at the required level of ecological benefit. While the violations that the settlement agreement purports to address are past violations only, the board's obligations are very much in the future. The board would be bound to find in the permit renewal that the existing cooling towers are the best technology available for the purpose of Section 316B. The settlement agreement would tie your hands and permit Diablo Canyon to operate for the rest of its life with the same antiquated cooling technology that has resulted in the devastating impacts to marine life that have been so well documented here. We strongly support the MLPA process and have been active participants in it. If PG&E and the board chose to put money toward the MLPA process as compensation for past violations of the thermal plan and Section 316B, rather than mitigation of ongoing and future impacts, we would support that decision. Although such contributions cannot constitute mitigation even under the existing rule, they certainly would promote the MLPA's objectives of protecting marine life and habitats, marine ecosystems, and marine natural heritage. Thank you for the opportunity to present these remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Christie. That is our last speaker. Dr. Bowker?
Just a point of clarification. As I understand it, aren't we dealing with resolving an issue for which we had a hearing how many years ago? I mean, how long has this been going on?
Too long.
Too long, a long time. So we're not looking to resolve future things with changes of legislation. What I would like to do is to finish what we started years ago. Is that right? Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, I don't know if we ever finished anything.
Exactly.
Other than
so,
we start,
I would like to put a string around this thing.
I appreciate that, and we've gone down a path, and we thought we had resolved, I think, the thermal effects.
But point being, the idea of waiting till legislation or court cases are resolved is not the issue before us. What we want to do is to put a string around what we've already started.
Well, staff is asking for our recommendation on how to proceed with these
direction
with, you know, habitats or MPAs, something of that nature. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to give my long spiel, having been on those lengthy hearings in the hotel years ago. Where to start? Okay. Let me talk about Diablo Lands for a little bit. Diablo Lands in that area is probably one of the most heavily studied coastal areas in the Central Coast. began with in the early 80s. There's over 30 years worth of data with the Wheel of North studies and so forth prior to the actual building and licensing of Diablo Canyon. So there's an enormous amount of data. Furthermore, because of security reasons, the lands have been protected from human impact. The watershed that feeds into the seas are the only agricultural use right now is very, very light grazing. And effectively, we've had a marine protected zone with the security 9/11 issues. Okay, so you've got this area that's set aside in a sense, or has been historically. My concern is one of what I would call incremental degradation, in which you have an area that changes over time, and you don't realize the changes that are taking place unless you have a reference point or benchmark to look to. Okay? And where this thought all came about was the field trip that we took to the Fields property, the areas north of the plant. And one need only compare the intertidal health, if you will, on Coralina Cove with the protected Fields Cove to the south. Okay? So what I would like to see happen is to establish a reference area or a benchmark. That process has partially been completed in that we have negotiated or tentatively agreed to a land intertidal-based environmental easement. If we were to couple that with an offshore easement, marine, of some sort, and I'm not sure what it is, the concept would be, here is a Central Coast area that is relatively free from anthropogenic impact. And you would use that in perpetuity to compare other coast areas, including state park, local Avila Beach where the creeks come in, all of those kinds of things. And so you're establishing the reference point in perpetuity from which you look at environmental degradation throughout this area. And so that is, I would like to see, and I'm not quite sure the terms, given that you already have a 1 mile radius of no fishing, no boats, in effect, whether you were to continue that area has no impact on fisheries at the present time, because they can't fish there anyways. I'm looking for to set aside a system that includes the terrestrial and what flows into the sea, the intertidal, and the near shore, that would serve in perpetuity as a benchmark to reference other coastal areas in the Central Coast.
What about the Coastal Commission's intermingling with this area you would like to protect?
Unfortunately, that happened because of our tardiness to come to a resolution. Had we moved precipitously, it would be moot.
Okay, but Dr. Backer, that is what it is. And so now
we're in a position
of saying, okay,
now we've got to negotiate elsewise.
But what you're proposing for the land-based portion, it doesn't have the same value that it did before. And I don't know that the Coastal Commission would want to limit public access.
I think in the near term, the access is going to be guided or controlled because of security reasons. It's sort of like, okay, so you've potentially you've lost the tail on the cow, but you still have the cow. I mean, you've lost a piece of what could have been, but you can live with that.
Okay.
What? There's nobody.
So, Dr. Bowker, how about in terms of the marine protected area idea versus the artificial habitat reef
I'm very much. Okay, my concern with the artificial reef is the idea that you're trading one. You're removing one natural habitat and putting in another one, right?
It sounded like it's not very. You're increasing the production tremendously,
right,
over a sandy bottom, and you would need less area.
Right. But that is, let's see if I can explain that. It's like the focus on production is not what's for human use, but you've also lost a natural area. It's sort of in many ways like putting in a garden. When you put in the garden, you have removed the natives, and that's a value judgment. And I'm really serious that I think there is a need for an area to reference what I call the incremental degradation of all areas of a similar type. And I don't see that kind of area in the Central Coast here.
I appreciate that, you know, where you're coming from. What I'm grappling with is that I'm trying to find a way myself that we're trying to focus in on the impacts that this plant is producing, which is loss of production. One way to look at it is loss of production of living resource that's being entrained. And I'm not trying to go too far afield from that, you know,
right,
with concepts that, although might be, could be very beneficial. I don't disagree with that.
Well, see, my concern is, I won't say concern, the thoughts are that the focus of the entrainment losses tend to be those organisms which are of sport or commercial value. Would you agree? I mean,
well, but they're somewhat representative. I mean, of not just the sport, but the
somewhere
ones that
along
aren't
here,
the ones studied.
Somewhere, I think we need to set aside a system, a natural system, that serves as a benchmark or a reference point to measure degradation in other similar systems.
Okay.
And I think that may be of greater long-term value than anything else we could have done.
Okay. Mr. Shallcross.
Yeah, I'd like a little clarification, too. At the beginning of the staff report, it sounds like what we're talking about is this NPDES permit that has been on hold forever and that we're trying to, not wrap it up. This is the permit to let them to continue to do work. And so I thought that this whole exercise was for us to address in their new permit how we're going to deal with the entrapment and impingement. Entrainment and impingement issue. And then later in the staff report, it starts talking about the cease and desist order, which includes the thermal stuff. And so now I'm not sure what these issues are going to. Is it going to that settlement that's still on or that's still out there, or is this going to their current permit that I think they're seeking and we're considering, or both?
Can I respond to that? I think it really goes to both. What happened was that the board adopted the settlement agreement subject to the subsequent adoption of the NPDES permit. The last hearing in July of 2003 was the hearing on the NPDES permit. And at the end of that hearing, the board charged the independent scientists to come back either with additional mitigation alternatives or with an explanation of how the mitigation alternatives had a nexus to both the thermal impacts and the entrainment impacts. The settlement agreement addressed both. And so now the TWG has come back with its study, and that's what is, we're putting out for public comment and for board comments. The next step at some point is that we need to issue an NPDES permit, either pursuant to a settlement. If it's pursuant to the current settlement, the settlement agreement may or may not have to be revised. But at the last informational workshop on this about a year ago, the independent scientist came back with a study of marine preserve areas, and there was a lot of public opposition, and the board wanted to hear more input about reefs, and that's where we are now. What we have to do is issue an NPDES permit. The permit has to comply with 316B, whatever 316B is at the time the permit is adopted. The cease and desist order issue is whether there was past compliance with the terms of the permit for thermal. I don't think staff is proposing to change the terms of the permit for thermal, but there was a dispute over whether the ongoing thermal discharges were in compliance with all of the terms of the permit. And so that was an enforcement hearing that was wrapped into the same settlement that would have addressed both 316B and thermal.
And do you recall whether the impingement and entrainment issues were also, were we charging that those were in violation of their former permit?
No.
Okay. So this is separate from the thermal impact issues, in which the regional board claimed that PG&E was in violation of their permit. Is that correct? Hello?
Well, the settlement agreement would have resolved the dispute about thermal.
Yeah, but yeah, I understand that, and there seems to be some problem with that now that they've opened up that area to the Coastal Commission's, you know, public access thing. So, I mean, I think that's for another day. I don't think that's what we're talking about here, are we?
Hasn't been the focus, that's for sure.
Okay, so that's not what you're looking for, any commentary on the settlement agreement or the cease and desist order.
Our main request for direction was on these two main areas that we've been talking about today as far as the entrainment issue.
So the question is, which one do we like the best? Is that the bottom line?
Kind of. Give staff direction with how to proceed at this point. But, you know, wrapped up in that, Gary, is what happens if, you know, the Second Circuit Court of Appeal drastically changes these rules such that what we do now, you know, what does happen, Lori? Would it be grandfathered if we do something now with mitigation restoration and then at some later date a court invalidates portions of those rules? What happens to what we did previous to that point in time? Is it invalidated?
If we adopted a permit now, it would have to comply with the 316B regs as they now stand. There's several ways to do that. One way would be to do site-specific findings that site-specific alternatives of what is required for BTA and make findings that these mitigation projects are going to meet those site-specific requirements. Basically, the site-specific requirements are quantified in terms of entrainment that's prevented or, to use a proxy, fish and shellfish that are produced. So whatever mitigation measures there would be to satisfy a site-specific alternative would have to somehow be quantifiable in terms of fish production. Another alternative would be to accept the valuation that PG&E has provided, and I think a lot of this is contingent on what the peer review says, and determine that given the value of meeting the requirements in the regulations and the costs of doing this work, either there's no feasible alternatives or some smaller scale alternative is appropriate. In the former case, we would just find that nothing else is required to meet BTA, and essentially, not essentially, that is what the draft permit found under the wholly disproportionate test. The draft permit from 2 years ago went through all the various restoration alternatives and found that none was feasible, and therefore BTA was satisfied. And as part of this negotiated settlement, there was going to be some mitigation for thermal and some mitigation for entrainment. If we draft findings that comply with the current regulations, what happens to the permit, depending on what the court does, the outcome depends on how much of the regulations, if any, the court validates. Obviously, if the court upholds the regulations, then nothing has to change. The court could completely invalidate the regulations, in which case we're back to the wholly disproportionate test, but the draft permit already makes findings that the package complies with the wholly disproportionate test. On the other hand, the court could uphold part of the regulations and strike down part of the regulations. I think it's pretty likely that the court will strike down the site-specific alternatives as they're currently written, but they could uphold the requirement that says you can do restoration as long as the restoration produces an environmental equivalent to reducing entrainment by 60% to 90%. Depending on what alternative we used at this point to find compliance with the regs, the permit might still be in compliance and it might not. If it's not, we would have to reopen it and do whatever we had to do to comply with the law. One problem with it is the way the regs are written now, if you find that there are site-specific 316B requirements or that the performance standards apply under the cost test, the permit has to include findings about the specific restoration measures chosen. So I don't see a way to just put money in an escrow account and do projects later under the current regulations. I think that the application has to identify projects and explain how they're going to produce more fish and shellfish. So that would have to be part of the package if the board was going to issue a permit that used restoration as part of BTA at this point. But I think the first step is clearly the peer review of the environmental analysis.
Okay. Mr. Hayashi.
So if I'm hearing what I'm hearing, regardless of whether we wait for a court decision, our number one point that we're waiting for is a peer review.
Right.
If the peer review comes out and it says that the scientist's side is the right, makes more sense, or if it comes out and says that the peer review says that the PG&E side makes the most sense, I mean, is that what we're waiting for? Then whatever side the peer review leans to would tend to give us a little bit, we would probably put a little bit more weight on the side of the peer review, would we not?
Well, we're going to balance that. We're going to make that decision.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there may be competing expert opinions that you would have to weigh.
Okay.
Exactly.
In the record except for an environmental analysis saying that ecological benefit of complying with these regulations is zero, then what PG&E is currently doing would be BTA.
So we're in a waiting game.
Right.
We're in a holding position until we can get the peer review to come back to us.
Well, right. Yes.
And we have the peer review. We also have the independent scientist paper and the habitat replacement cost analysis. PG&E's position is that you can't use that in the benefits valuation, and so we need that to be peer reviewed.
Michael.
Well, I just want to point out, we are moving ahead with peer review. We're talking to experts now. And the board shouldn't think that you're going to get an answer with peer review. You're going to get more opinions. You know, when we hire independent scientists, independent biological scientists to help us out on this, you get more opinions. You're going to get the same thing when we do peer review and the economics report. So, you know, that old saying about trying to get economist's degree on anything. is valid, I think. So you're really going to get more opinions. You won't necessarily get the grand unified solution.
Well, but that's what we need.
Yes.
From other perspectives, other economists weighing in on this, mm-hmm. instead of just from one side.
I agree, and yeah. we're going to do it.
Right.
And I also wanted to point out that talking about our options is moving forward with the permit from here, is that no other agencies have attempted to implement the new 316B regulations that we know of, no other agencies. They're all doing information requests, which in essence puts off the decision for many, many months down the road. I think that what people are doing is hoping for a resolution from the court.
Let's test the waters.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I skipped that grandfathering provision. One of the alternatives for findings in a permit, if a permit was to be issued now, would be to direct PG&E to complete any additional study requirements, including studies of potential mitigation or restoration plans, and they have to do it as soon as reasonably practicable, but no later than January of 2008. So a third alternative under the current regulations is basically to grandfather this and apply the wholly disproportionate test in the meantime.
You know, at some time and point, there comes a time where we've studied this thing to death already. I mean, we have reports after reports after reports that nobody's tested the waters. Why don't we test the waters?
Well, I agree with that, but it's not so much we haven't done enough testing and studying. The law has been in flux, and that's been the moving target, is to take what we know and try to set it against a standard that we think is going to be there for a while. So I would like to go ahead and test it as soon as we can. Gary.
Yeah. It sounds to me like the reasonable thing to do is to wait and gather more information. I think staff's done a good job, and we're going in the right direction. The peer review sounds like a good idea. I mean, we're going to be doing it, obviously, and we want to wait for that for sure. I'm wondering, Chair Young mentioned perhaps we could get our own economists to do, I mean, because what we're looking at is Dr. Ramani's biological, we're weighing the biological report against an economist report, and they're not talking apples and oranges, even though they're talking about a related issue. And so if we could get an economist to do an economist. Yeah, thank you, report, then at least we're talking apples and oranges. We can look at their guys and our guys and sort of weigh that. And that hopefully will take us, up to the time when the court makes some sort of decision, and we can get a little more. Well, it's almost going to take it to that. It's going to be like next summer or something,
yeah.
Anyway.
But I can agree with it. I could agree with waiting to get the peer review and then go on from there,
right?
Whether the court's made their decision or not.
Well, they'll be probably about the same time.
All right.
So then the second thing is on the thermal effects thing. I don't see why we have to put that on hold while all this is going on. Why don't we bring an ACL or something? It sounds like this whole settlement agreement thing is falling apart. It's just sitting there doing nothing. So why don't we bring that to a head? Give PG&E something to do in the meantime.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Thomas.
I could update the board a little on the public access issue with the Coastal Commission that might help you decide about the ACO, pursuing the ACL issue. As you know, the Coastal Commission did require PG&E to open up the easement area to public access. And in their requirement, they have a number, they say up to 275 people a day. And there will be a trail put in along the bluffs. Now, what PG&E has to do is come up with an access plan. And it doesn't mean that PG&E has to come up with an access plan that allows or trucks in 275 people a day. They can come up with an access plan that limits access according to certain parameters like security, safety, and biological protection. So PG&E could come up with a plan that is much more limited than 275 people a day and present that to the Coastal Commission. And they can include in that protective measures. They could include docent-led hikes, a constructed trail such that people would be required to stay on the trail, not go off it, and there would be no resulting biological impacts, little or no impacts, and monitored, you know, you could monitor over time. So we could come up, or PG&E could come up with an access plan that results in little or no biological impacts to the terrestrial area, to the bluffs, and to the intertidal zone. That is a possibility. Whether the Coastal Commission would adopt it or not, I don't know. But it is a possibility for PG&E to come up with such a plan and include monitoring to ensure that there are no impacts. That would then meet the requirements of the easement as it is currently written, and it would provide what Mr. Barker was talking about, is that you would have this area that is protected versus other areas that are not. It could act as a reference point. You could also take those access management measures and export them elsewhere, like say to Montana de Oro, to improve the conditions there. So I wouldn't take the easement off the table. I would look at options for making the easement work, even though there is this access requirement.
I think it would please the members of the board if they move forward and got that done.
I would suggest, based upon the recommendation from our consultants on one condition of the public access, I agree with the regulation of it. It should be tightly regulated and probably establish a docent group that would be willing to guide the parties down there. But I think one thing that needs to be put in there is to language that prohibits any of the public going into the tide pools.
That's correct.
Because that is by looking at the most susceptible and vulnerable ecosystem is that tide pool section.
I agree. The way the access requirements are written now, and PG&E can correct me if I'm wrong here, the way I understand them is there is a bluff top trail, but there is no access to the intertidal zone along that 3 miles of coast. There's only one point of access, and that's to a beach, which is at the very beginning of the trail, which would be right at Montana de Oro at Coon Creek. So there's access to the beach at Coon Creek, but nothing south of that point, which is what we would want.
Michael, how long is that access going to be? What was the Coastal Commission's determination of period of time?
The access is permanent. My understanding is the access would be permanent.
Permanent.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Briggs.
To try to bring this to a conclusion, if I could recommend the main points I think we've been talking about. Some of them, it sounds like there's pretty good agreement. Others, maybe not so much agreement. But we'll proceed with the peer review. We've already been working, as Michael said, on getting that done. We should pursue the easement protection to preserve that component of the settlement. I don't think it's fair to say that the settlement is down the tubes because of the Coastal Commission's action. We will fight to make sure the Coastal Commission doesn't trample that land. Yes. But that's what we have been doing already. We will continue to do that. And as Michael says, I think there's a real possibility that we could end up with a situation that Dr. Bowker is talking about where it'll be minimal. And so that the vast majority of the benefits of the conservation easement would remain and could be a good fit, could continue to be a good fit for the thermal aspects of the once cooling water. And then the third component of this, which probably has the least agreement of the three, would be to continue to explore the idea of proceeding with the marine protected areas. And I think one of the areas to explore would be what is the potential benefit of doing that. And we've heard conflicting things from Fish and Game, from the fishermen. You know, it was interesting that the fishermen didn't really like it because it might mean that they'd actually go into effect or that there'd be more of them. Well, that tells me that maybe there really is some leveraging here to be accomplished from this. So I think it would be helpful to explore that more with Fish and Game in terms of what's the actual viability and would it really be helpful and make the whole process more viable by having extra funds available and make them more effective in terms of implementation. So you know, there are a lot of things in legislation that are required, but they don't happen because they're not funded. And we think that maybe this one falls into that category or could continue to fall into that category. So I think it, given the status of where we are timing-wise, it makes sense to keep that option open. Let us provide some additional information for you in terms of that possibility for marine protected areas. And the reason I think it's worth pursuing that is because we have agreement from the independent scientists and from Fish and Game that that makes the most sense in terms of the marine ecology. And so it would be very short-sighted to say, well, it's not a perfect nexus, so we're going to ignore the fact that that's the most benefit to the marine ecology. I think that would be very short-sighted, so I'd hate to shut the door on that at this point. So I think it makes sense to pursue that.
Okay, what about Mr. Shallcross's suggestion that we kind of wrap up the past violations with the thermal impact? I mean, the easement thing is a part of that, but his suggestion is that staff issue an ACL and we maybe bring all this to a head with that issue.
I don't think that would exactly wrap it up. It would probably take longer to do that than potentially resolving this by the recommendation that I made as far as trying to make sure that the original idea that the board agreed to as far as the conservation easement could continue in the future by virtue of the Coastal Commission's access being so limited that it would be insignificant in terms of the damage to the easement. I think that would be the better avenue as far as, quote, wrapping up the thermal aspect of it. If we could nail that down with the Coastal Commission, I think we could do that in a shorter time than we could pursue basically reopening an enforcement action. But that's my opinion.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Jeffries.
Well, there's one component I think was left out is for us to have an economist look at our environmental group's analysis.
That's part of the peer review. Yes.
Okay, that's part of the peer review.
Yeah.
And I have some concerns about us establishing MPAs or even giving monies to MPAs. I don't know if there's a nexus to it. And I think Dr. Bowker really hit the nail on the head when he said there's a large area at Diablo Canyon is already, it's not called an MPA, but it's a zone that you can't take fish from. And as I stated earlier, I guess this morning, I had concerns about the impacts it would do to commercial fishermen as well as recreational fishing. And there's a trickle-down effect that goes to boat sales and goes to using fuel and selling licenses and hooks and line and you name it. And, of course, I'm coming from a perspective as being a chair of a harbor district that could affect this as well because Moss Landing is one of the largest commercial fishing harbors in the state of California. And the impacts upon the commercial fishermen has really devastated the whole industry. And I think that for us to get into MPAs is really out of our jurisdiction, my personal opinion. My duty is to protect water quality of California. Fish and Game is the one that should be identifying areas of concerns of fishing. I know we get upset on this board when the Coastal Commission steps on our toes in areas that we don't think that they have responsibility. So I would just caution this board that let's don't go too far on this. I think the reef idea, and I think where this all came from some many months ago, is when this board said to our experts, what do you think about this settlement? And they gave us their opinion. And now they're back with that opinion, and here we are. But now we seem to be drifting off into other areas, and we forgot to focus back on the original settlement that we had with PG&E and the whole idea of what to do. And I think that we, some of us that were here at that particular time, pounded out a very good settlement, but there were some questions from the environmental group, and I appreciate their opinion. And I support their opinion that the reef would be an excellent idea. But whether we make it an MPA or a no-take zone, I think that's a different thing that needs to be looked at, and I don't think that's our jurisdiction to really make that decision. I think that's what Fish and Game is for. But again, I'm looking at the other side of the coin. What economic effect is this going to have on the fishing industry, whether it's commercial or whether it's recreation? So with that, I would caution the board, let's don't go too far afield. Let's stick to water quality issues and the thing that we know best. And I think Lori really brought us back to where we came from on this whole thing when she gave her analogy, and I appreciate that because I was going to do that just before she spoke, is that I don't know what's going to happen with the rules, whether this appeals court is going to overchange the law or not. But I would hate for us to go forward and then have to come back again. And we've done that so many times. Seems like we're sitting here spinning our wheels and not going anywhere. If we had acted a couple years ago, we wouldn't be in this position we are in today. And the Coastal Commission wouldn't have the opportunity to do what they did. And I think the whole idea for that whole coastal area was to keep the public basically out of it, except for scientific groups going in there to take scientific analysis. And I thought that was a great idea, especially when you look at and you say, well, you know, 250 people and you can have docents and so forth, but you still got people tramping on the land and you could cause erosion, which could cause environmental problems. So with that, Mr. Chair, I agree to some of the staff's analysis, but I would caution the board on what we do about MPAs and no-take zones, because I think that's a whole different issue, and it's not really in our jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction, again, is to protect water quality of California.
Well, what I'd like us to do is kind of chop this up into two things. One is what we do with the MPA artificial reef concept at this point in the 316B regs and what direction that we want to give staff. And then I would like to address the other issue that Mr. Shallcross raised, Don, with the potential resolution of the thermal impacts. So let's try to get the first resolved at this point, okay? Are we all in agreement that we want to, the peer review is going to go ahead anyway, okay? So that's what we need. And as far as continuing to explore MPAs and artificial reefs, I would agree with what Mr. Jeffries has said with this. And I've heard enough that the MPAs may be, in a much more conceptual sense, better in the long run, or may have some benefit down the line. I am more comfortable with the artificial reef concept. I think I heard enough comment that it would be a very viable and doable method to increase production. And the MPAs don't increase production unless you start keeping fishermen out and other extractive uses. And that, to me, adds a complexity to this that I don't think that we need to get into. I feel uncomfortable about that. I don't think that the commercial fishermen should suffer from something that they had, you know, no part in creating. They're the unintended loss in this. The artificial reef concept I like. I think staff should pursue that. I'd like it to get refined. I'd like to know more about, if there's more work to be done in terms of what actual size and components and costs can be fleshed out on that, I think that would be very worthwhile. But that's my take on that. But I think we need to give staff direction on where we want them to be going with these two concepts, because they're going to put time and effort into NPAs, and if we don't agree with that at this point, now's the time for us to weigh in. So I like the artificial reef concept. I think they should focus more on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, wouldn't the peer review analyze that, because that's basically the recommendation of the scientists, that the artificial reef would be. Chime in here, fellas.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Briggs had said staff was going to continue to explore as an option, and so that's what I'm trying to address, is what staff itself.
And tied in, that would be an economic analysis of that.
So the question for the peer reviewers would be more along the lines of, if you're looking at artificial reef, how the numbers shake out, this value judgment.
Okay.
Again, assuming artificial reef. That's more the argument there.
Even more so, Roger, it's the value of the entrainment losses. What are they worth? That's the real question that the peer reviewers are going to look at. They're not going to look at the solution to the problem. How do you make up for those losses? They're going to look at the value of the entrainment losses. How do you value that?
Right. Okay.
I think Michael's just right. I mean, I think it's almost like if we're looking at where do we put the money, it's putting the horse before the cart. We don't even know what the money amount is. If the money amount turns out to be $450,000, like PG&E was one of their numbers, then we ain't putting any reef anywhere. I don't know if I'm going to spend a whole lot of time, analyzing reefs or anything else until we figure out what an appropriate, reasonable amount is. And then when we have that nailed down, then that would be a good time to say, okay, now what do we do with it? Or you can do it both concurrently, but
I would agree to that. I think that's fine and it makes sense. So we just proceed with the peer review at this point. Do we have our own? Can we get our own economist to advise us?
Yes.
We're working with Stratus, I guess.
Okay. All right. Okay, so that, Dr. Hunter?
Just for the record, yes, I also support the notion that our task is to look for, seek solutions to increase fish production, fish abundance. And from what I heard today, and with other efforts that are going on to improve management of marine resources, I think the contribution of the artificial reef is something that would help to increase the benefits, not only in terms of goals to better manage our fisheries, but in terms of the recreational values and the other benefits that accrue to the residents of our state and visitors alike. So I would like to see us have a little more information to work with on the artificial reef concept.
Okay. I had a little bit of clarification. I think that concern about the our agency stepping out into areas that we're probably not authorized or putting in, whether or not we're going to put in an artificial reef or something like that. I think it would be impossible, even though if that's the choice that the board wants to have, direct staff to look into it. I don't think that it can be done without having other agencies particularly Fish and Game and probably NOAA and somebody else, they're all going to have to be involved in it. So I think that the concern about it, the board and staff of this agency going off on making a decision like that is going to be necessarily a very joint effort by
a lot of other agencies are concerned with the.
Yeah, clearly under either of these two options, there's going to be permitting issues and there's going to be CEQA issues. Because if the restoration measure is that PG&E will fund a marine reserve that we wouldn't create, it would be fish and game, but it's our requirement that's causing the funding to happen, there's still, fish and game still has to establish the reserve. They still have to do an EIR. Same thing with the reef. I don't know what other agencies have to permit them, but I assume there's at least a couple, and we'd have to do an EIR first as well. Or someone would.
Okay, what's the time frame for peer review?
Well, a gross estimate, I think we could have peer review done in 6 months.
Okay. Okay.
And when's the court supposed to make its decision?
Next summer.
So it's about 6 months.
Yeah. Dr. Foster.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. One.
Microphone.
Come up to the microphone.
I'm confused because I think there's somehow being confused here of fundamentally an ecological argument and an economic argument. The habitat production foregone analysis that we participated in with Dr. Raimondi is an estimate of what kind of habitat you need to replace the lost resources of the operation of the power plant. It turns out that you would need an artificial reef of the sizes that we explained. The fact that that happens to cost, whatever it costs, is a whole other issue. You see what I mean? I think PG&E's conflated the two, and I don't think they're related at all.
Lori, are they related?
Well, they're related in the sense that there are some limitations in the regulations about what we can require. We have a settlement agreement that's still on the table that has dollar amounts in it. So, I don't really have anything more to say than that. Does that answer your question?
Not really. Not helpful enough.
Well, what the board wanted to know is what sort of restoration measures are available that would mitigate for the entrainment impacts, and that's what the independent scientists did. That's the information they gave. They analyzed the nexus and what size reef is necessary to mitigate for the amount of entrainment that's happening. So that's one aspect of what that information is useful for. Under the regulations, there's one of the ways to comply with the 316B regulations is that the PG&E can do a restoration program that doesn't cost significantly more than the benefits of complying with the regulations. The question is, what is the benefit of complying with the regulations? One way to determine that is to say, well, it would cost this much to build a reef that would replace all the fish that are being entrained, so that must be the value. PG&E's position is that that equates cost with value, and that's not the same thing. Other valuation methodologies are the commercial value and the recreational value of the fish that are entrained, what people would be willing to pay to not have entrainment. So those kinds of valuations are not related to what the independent scientists do. And the question, and the reason we need peer review, is what other possible valuation methodologies are out there?
And I guess maybe kind of addressing Dr. Foster's comment, if cost was irrelevant, then I'm afraid we could take the position that they should just put in dry cooling towers. And then we would dispense with, you know, all thermal and entrainment impacts.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
Well.
Come on, Dr. Foster. Come up.
I would agree with you, except that, in fact, if one of your charges is to protect the environment, beneficial uses, and all those sorts of things, your first concern should be the ecology. And I don't think that $8 million we presented is disproportionate. It's certainly disproportionately low compared to dry cooling or anything else. So from that test, I would argue that it's a pretty cheap way out.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that comment. Well, okay. What we're going ahead. Yes. Dr. Raimondi.
Mike, I just wanted to ask a question, and that is, I was unaware of the time frame for the review, which seems really long to me. But, and what I wanted to do is get your input towards staff direction as to whether we should do a little more work that would not take that much more work. But what I'm concerned about is that if it takes 6 months to get review, and then there's going to be a comment period or something after the review. There's a number of things that we have not yet done. As an example, getting good cost estimates. We've got these estimates that are from another location, and Connolly Pacific, the only group that does this stuff, said they could start providing, you know, more realistic estimates if we gave them some more information. So, what I'm wondering is, should there be some concurrent work that's done by staff to better inform you guys at a nearer time than a year from now about what the cost might be associated with this?
Yes.
Okay.
The answer is yes.
Yes. We're going to move ahead with getting better cost estimates on the reef as fast as possible. We're going to move ahead with peer review as fast as possible. Okay. I'm not going to take up that 6 months if it's not necessary.
Okay.
I still remain a little chary, if you will, cautious about an artificial reef replacing a natural area, whatever that natural area is. It's sort of like, well, I won't go into analogies because I'll mess it up, but fundamentally it bothers me to put in a technological fix to something that could be other.
Yes. John, come on up. Go ahead.
Sorry, I don't mean to take up any more time, but it's appropriate for that last comment. It reflects on some of what you've been discussing. You have comments from Department of Fish and Game and NOAA Fisheries stating that they support artificial reefs as a mitigation in this context and do not support the use of marine protected areas in this context. So hopefully that will help guide your decision-making with regards to the clear loss of soft bottom habitat for implementing an artificial reef program. In general, I would agree with you that a technological fix to a natural problem doesn't tend to work. However, this is one of the few cases in California where we have real scientific evidence of an artificial reef program used for mitigation for this type of impact, and it's working very well. And it was well designed and well implemented, and it wasn't, as one of the commenters said, just dumping a bunch of debris in the ocean, which is something that used to happen. It's clearly a scientifically valid method.
Okay. I think we're done with this part of what's in front of us, okay? Now, let's move to the other component of this that Mr. Shallcross raised, and this is where we may have some disagreement on the board, and we're just going to have to see where the chips fall with this. Mr. Shallcross has suggested that, and I am supportive, really, of tending to bring the past thermal impacts to some kind of resolution. I don't know that the easement issue, although it's on the table, we've never consummated that agreement. And I was one who changed his vote with that, and I take responsibility for that. However, I want to see if we can't, take a pulse for where we should go at this point in terms of getting that resolved. And I would not mind seeing some enforcement action brought to a conclusion with the thermal impacts. I know that we had testimony years ago, even before I got on the board, I don't know if more testimony is needed or whether the board has to just review that hearing, Lori and Roger, or whether we would be best served by going through that again. Maybe the easement issue is still part of that. Maybe it isn't. Maybe there's a monetary penalty involved in that. Maybe it is not. But that's where I'm headed with this, and so I'd like to see how the rest of you weigh in, and we can give staff direction with what we want to do with it. And I'll start at the far end with Mr. Hayashi, and we'll just move down the board.
It must have been about 6 years ago when I first came, maybe longer than that when I first came to the board. Roger came to my office and gave me a briefing telling me what was going on. It was right at the 11:30 hour before the first PG&E meetings, and they delivered 14 banker's boxes with material. And he says, the meeting's in 2 weeks. You need to know everything in those boxes. Well, that's all well done and passed us, and we've here. So we've got all the way up to this where we've negotiated this settlement that we've almost consummated. I think we got through the easement issue today. If Mr. Thomas could word it right and get it through the Coastal Commission, which I think the Coastal Commission would probably agree with us because their interest should be in preservation just as well as ours. I would like to see this thing come to an end. It was mentioned that maybe we should issue an ACL, but Roger has commented that he thinks he could get it done faster without issuing an ACL. If that's the case, I would just go with Roger's suggestion and just get this thing done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Bowker.
I would like to echo that. I'm very, very much in favor of cleaning up that issue, tidying up, resolving it. And I think that our delay in terminating that issue has resulted in the Coastal Commission. I mean, had we had the easement in place, then the Coastal Commission deliberations would have been different. So that settlement is vulnerable the longer we wait. And so I'm very much in favor of tidying it up. However.
Well, what about an ACL?
No, I think Roger has the greater experience on how to best expedite this, and I would go with his recommendations.
Okay. Mr. Shallcross.
Yeah. I'm sort of torn on this. I usually like to defer to Roger.
Yeah, right.
Except when I don't feel I can. One of my concerns on this is, and, you know, it wasn't just the board who was responsible for this thing being dragged out. It was a mutual thing, and it took a long time to work out. My concern is that the value of the easement has gone, in my mind anyway, has gone from worth something to worth almost nothing. With the imposition of the sort of 9/11 zone around the plant, and also if indeed they're going to be leaving nuclear or waste on the property, I have a feeling that it's going to be restricted at some level to the public doing a whole lot there. And so I'm really wondering now what the easement's worth. Now, if we're letting the Coastal Commission, have and really their interest is public access, not so much conservation. From my experience, they'd probably be thrilled to have 10,000 people down there a day. And if it's like something like 250 a day, 275 a day, I think that's way more than we were envisioning. What we had on the table was basically just the cows that are there. And this changes it a whole lot in my mind from what I was agreeing to. So I'm real concerned about this being the same deal. It would be faster to try and pull this together and see what we can get out of it.
I don't think it's what we originally agreed to, but I'm concerned that what we're getting is not what we originally thought we were getting or agreed to. And so I don't have a problem with doing an ACL. I'm not the one who's going to insist on doing it, even if I could. But I would like to see some resolution. Maybe we could just go ahead and bring the cease and desist order back and move on that. I mean, that would be pretty quick if what you're looking for is a quick solution.
Well, but they can't cease.
What do you mean they can't cease?
Well, they can't cease the discharge.
They have a switch?
Well. A big switch, but
okay. What I'm feeling like is right here is like, okay, we made this deal several years ago that's sort of sitting out there, never was finalized, and now we're saying we don't want to do anything to screw that up. I mean, why would PG&E do anything now? I mean, if we're not going to do anything, which apparently we're not, you know.
Okay, so you're in favor of some type of enforcement action coming back to us?
Yeah, and I mean, whatever.
The easement thing in your mind has less value.
Whatever staff thinks is appropriate. I think the deal is gone south as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, Dr. Villeneuve.
Well, I concur, and so it's.
With what?
You know, it was a lost opportunity. Not through anybody's fault, but it just sort of fell through the cracks, and I Mr. Shellcost said succinctly, "It's just get whatever you can out of it." And I don't know about the ACL. I think that would probably be a also fruitless. I'll leave it to the our manager here that has far more expertise in looking for ways to get out of this thing. But it should be done.
So you're neutral on any type of enforcement?
I have no preference as to, I don't think it matters.
Okay. All right. Mr. Jeffries.
Well, I agree with all my colleagues.
Clear direction.
I think each one of them has a good point. But how do we sort it out and make it work? I agree with Mr. Shellcross. I don't think the property that we originally envisioned that would be held it has the same values it had before. And he's also right that the Coastal Commission, their theory is to have public access. And I really don't have a problem with that, except this particular part of the coast is a very special part of the coast in California. And we were trying to protect that by having that easement that would be very, very restrictive of public access. We had some latitude, of, as I mentioned earlier, that with permission and scientific scientists be able to work in that area, that was a permissible type thing. But to allow up to 250 people to tromp up and down the bluffs was not my idea of the original concept of that particular piece of property. I too would like to have this come to some conclusion sooner than later. I would at least like to have it come before I leave this board, which
you're going to be here forever.
I don't think I'm going to be here forever, but it's. You know, I don't mind giving our executive officer the go-ahead to see what he could salvage out of this whole thing. And if it's not what this board would like, then we can pursue the ACLs and go that direction.
Well, the salvage means the easement.
Yes.
Okay.
Because I where we had a multi-million dollar piece of property basically tied up now is open to the public. So, you know, if you look at it, real estate, to me, it's only worth
maybe a penny on the dollar of what it was worth before.
So what's there to salvage?
Well, it's... I really don't know what our staff can negotiate with the Coastal Commission, if that's a possibility. I don't know if the Coastal Commission really realizes what we were trying to do and what we were trying to protect. They may have been looking at something in a different direction than, and I don't know if our staff related that to them, or maybe they even understood it. In most cases, they probably didn't understand it.
Well, PG&E certainly understood it.
Well, PG&E understands it, but it was easy for the... Well, you know, I'm not going to speculate what PG&E thought. But, you know, we've been through PG&E going through bankruptcy and out of bankruptcy. And time's marching on. We need to come to conclusion on this, and the sooner that we can do that, the better off we will be. Not only for PG&E, but for the people of California.
Okay. Dr. Hunter.
I'm going to be really brief because you know, this is an issue that you have all had a chance to look at from many different aspects and to consider a number of ideas in terms of finding ways to mitigate for these impacts. You know, I find Mr. Shellcroft's assessment, you know, in terms of looking at the easement as a reasonable and equivalent way of addressing the issues that are wrapped up with the thermal impacts. I mean, I don't hear support for an ACL, although I would support that in reviewing. But since I don't hear that from my fellow board members, probably that idea is not going to go anywhere. I guess, you know, the idea that we need to wrap this up quickly is also something that impresses upon me. You know, the options we have are probably pretty limited at this point. If Mr. Briggs were to look at that easement and we were to go back and talk with the Coastal Commission and assure that we are clear in communicating our original intent, I mean, how long would that take? And then at that point, if we realized, you know, that really the what we're gaining is the absolute minimum and that we would want to reconsider an ACL, what are we looking at in terms of time?
The PG&E is supposed to provide a plan pretty soon. It's supposed to be this fall. Is it October?
June next year.
Oh, it's June next year? I thought there was something due this fall. Oh, maybe that's what I was thinking of. The plan's due in June. So that doesn't mean that we wouldn't be trying to continue to convince the Coastal Commission, because, yes, we have made our opinions known to the Coastal Commission before the Coastal Commission meeting, since the Coastal Commission meeting, in which this was imposed on PG&E. So we've certainly communicated already, and we will continue to work with this group. I was thinking it was a little sooner time frame than that. So what that means is it's going to be somewhat consistent with the estimate for this lawsuit next summer. But I think it's very possible that even before then we'd have an idea of whether or not the Coastal Commission is swayed by our concerns in terms of coastal resource protection. So I think still by springtime we'll have a good idea about which way that's going to go.
What's the time frame for an ACL action?
Well, there a couple things have been thrown out here. One is ACL, one is cease and desist order. Let me address the cease and desist order first. Just to remind the board, you've already, as Mr. Hayashi was talking about, we've already had the evidentiary hearing, and there was a question about whether there would have to be additional time for comment. I think the answer to that is yes, because so much time has elapsed. Not just comment, but perhaps additional testimony. And it would also behoove all the board members. We may actually have another board member before long. So it would behoove all the board members to review the existing evidence, to allow submittal of additional evidence, limited in scope, I would imagine, and then reconvene the hearing and I would say that a minimum for that would be 4 months before we could have that whole process play out. Lori, you can chime in there as far as my whether I'm realistic or not.
4 months or what?
From now.
Well, in terms of realistic timing, I think it's more how much time everyone needs to review all the evidence. And I would be a little stronger than saying it would behoove all the board members to review the record. Any board members that didn't participate in the prior hearings would have to review the record and
right.
read the transcript in order to participate. And I would strongly suggest that all the board members do that because it was 5.5 years ago. In terms of taking additional evidence, I agree that we would have to do that because of the time that's gone by. I don't think there's any reason to scrap what's already in the record, and I think that the additional evidence could be limited to any changes in the thermal impacts since the hearing. But at least that issue would have to be addressed. And just to refresh the board's recollection or for the information of the new board members, what the cease and desist order required was that either the discharger would submit a report describing physical and operational power plant modifications that would result in compliance with certain permit limits, and those are described in the staff report, basically the protection of beneficial uses and avoidance of nuisances. So the discharger had to submit a report by, well, the date's outdated now, describing what plant modifications could achieve compliance with that, and then recommend an alternative and a schedule for achieving compliance through implementation of the alternative. So that would actually be to change the thermal discharge. Or in the alternative, the discharger could submit a proposal and schedule for protecting marine beneficial uses through alternative measures. And what the easement is was a settlement of that hearing. In terms of the ACL, again, if an ACL were instituted, there wouldn't be a settlement unless there was a subsequent settlement. But the timing, I think, would be similar. There would be the same issues of proof, and they're basically the same issues, whether or not PG&E is violating those provisions of the permit due to the thermal impacts of the plant. And that the hearing hadn't been concluded, so nothing had been proven yet.
And that was a CDO hearing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we have to go back all the way. We have to go all the way. We can't just start picking from where we left off?
No, she said we can start
from
where we left off and have a limited hearing.
Okay.
Right, but not with an ACL because it would be a new action. A lot of the evidence would already be developed, but you would still have to reintroduce it.
Did the CDO include monetary penalties?
No.
So anyway, I think Lori's not disagreeing. 4 months is probably on the skinny side, and 6 months is probably more reasonable. And part of that would be fairness to the board members as far as having sufficient lead time to go back. First of all, we have to gather all that stuff up again and review the evidence just for the cease and desist order hearing. ACL would have completely different findings, and so it's probably a similar time frame.
Well, my own, you know, preference with this, and I think what got me kind of twisted around in the beginning, because I wasn't here for the CDO hearing. I came into this process when we had the easement put in front of us and the vote, and I voted for that. It was not unanimous. And, you know, I'm the one who's changed his mind on the value of that, and I feel that it just it's inconsequential to the value of the resource that has been extracted. And we're here to protect the public's resource. We pay for the power. PG&E gets the right to use the water. We pay PG&E for the electricity. And I just feel that in order to properly protect the public's resource, that there's got to be a better valuation given to that loss due to the thermal impact. So I've been very uncomfortable the past year or two with kind of the road we've been going down with this. I would prefer to see an ACL come forward
but we've got a mix of opinion on the board. I guess there is a sentiment that we could give Roger some leeway to see what can be done with the Coastal Commission, at least, because we don't have a full dozen eggs now. We've got a half dozen. And so it's even less than what we thought it was before. And what we thought it was before, in my mind, was not enough. And although the concept of that easement is beneficial to the environment, and, you know, I don't want you to get the impression, I'm talking to the rest of the board here, that I don't think it doesn't have value. I want something that's more related to the impact. As a penalty and a consequence for the PG&E opinions that the discharge, the thermal effects was going to be temporary, it was going to be seasonal, was only going to extend out of the cove about a quarter mile or half mile down the cove, and it turned out to be a very much different type of impact than what came about. And I know the language in the State Water Resources Control Board opinion on this, which said that the regional board had power to go back and revisit this at some later point and decide whether the impacts were reasonable or not. So, I don't even know where we're at, really, except to give Roger some leeway to, I guess, look at the... explore something with the Coastal Commission. I think there's three of us maybe that would go ahead, you know, would be supportive of an ACL. Dr. Villeneuve is somewhat neutral about that, and the three of you remaining board members, I guess, would not like to have that as an option. So,
well, I'd like to see Mr. Briggs pursue and see what he could. What the analysis is going to be, but if it's not like we intended it to be, then we're going to have to move forward with some kind of enforcement. But I want to give the staff the option to make that happen.
And how much time?
Well, I would think they would know within 2 or 3 months that which way this is going to go with the Coastal Commission. Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, we haven't had much luck.
Well, I know. Well, if we don't have much luck, if we hit a stone wall, then I think we just should move on.
We won't know in a couple of months. That the access plan is due in by June, and that's when we'll know. PG&E will write an access plan, and I anticipate that it will be restrictive, and that it will be protective, because PG&E has an incentive here. They want to write an access plan that is protective of that bluff area so that the board accepts it, the regional board accepts it. Whether the Coastal Commission will accept it or not, we don't know. We won't know until June.
Well, can't we talk to the Coastal Commission and find out what they're thinking? What might be acceptable and what might
yes,
not?
Yes, we can do that.
Then we can have an idea of where...
Yes.
And then we can decide whether that fits with what we're looking at.
Yes.
I mean, we are at odds with them. They want public access and we don't. Everything that you read about the Coastal Commission is public access issues. I don't blame them for that. That's part of their statutory duties, but we're coming from the other extreme.
Yes, that's why I'm emphasizing that we will not know. I'm not saying to you, let me go and talk to Peter Douglas and I can convince him. And I'm not telling you that. I'm not under the delusion that I can do that. So,
but their theory is to have that open to 200 to 300 people a day. That's not going to be acceptable to me. That's not restricted, even if you have docents, because people have a tendency to wander off, and pretty soon they're leaning over the edge of a bluff, and then you got erosion and so forth. You know, this board even grappled with restricting cows walking on the land at one time. I mean, that's what we're looking at. So,
And from my perspective, Michael, I don't necessarily want you to go and beat on the Coastal Commission to bring them down. No. I mean, it's like find out what their bottom line is and then report back to us, and then we'll decide whether we can live with that or not.
Yeah, you can probably do that by the next board meeting.
You should be able to reach accommodation because although they're there's the Coastal Commission has as part of their mission to open the coastal zone to public access. They also have another part of their mission, and that is to protect coastal resources. So they've got a dual purpose there. And you know, if you can get an agreement to moderate their, if they have indeed, you know, we don't know what their plan is. You know, I think the assumption was they're going to, because they came up with that number, what, 250 or 300 people, whatever it is, that may be just, you know, sort of a working start. And just so I would point out, Coastal Act does specifically identify their mission as protection of coastal resources.
Okay, we're going to wrap this up. So,
just a quick one.
Go ahead.
There's a coastal advisory board that meets, that PG&E is meeting with, right? And we have membership on that board, is that correct? We have a representative, at least it's on their list.
If you're talking about the task force related to the access issue, yes.
Okay. So their deliberations are coming back to us. Can we get our kind of a, I mean, if we have a board representative or a staff person, how does their deliberations come back to the board, or don't they? Or the, at least you can transmit our feelings on it.
Yes, but
and I think if I may also say that our feelings are parallel with probably PG&E's feelings about limited access.
Yes, I would say that members of the task force would be inclined to be more restrictive about public access, such that the resources would be protected. However, their job is not to address the access issue. Their job is to assess the current baseline condition of that area against which to measure future changes. So they're not addressing the access issue. They're addressing current biological conditions as baseline. The access plan is written by PG&E, PG&E alone, and then PG&E takes that plan to the Coastal Commission for consideration.
And can we go along with, well, I'm interested in the flow of information between that group, PG&E, Coastal Commission, so that we're kind of in the loop.
We're definitely in the loop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, wrapping this up then, can staff get back to us by the next board meeting with the status report on efforts made with the Coastal Commission to just to feel out what their position is?
Well, we can certainly
try
ask that, but I think, as Michael said, we're not going to know until next June, and the history of the Coastal Commission has also been that even if staff has made a recommendation, there's no guarantee that the commission is going to heed that recommendation. So we'll know what the staff is willing to tell us in terms of their inclination, but that's,
well, let's get a hold of,
it's not going to be worth a huge amount.
Right, let's get a hold of Mr. Douglas if you can, and just inquire, get a sense so you can report back to us on what their numbers are on access and whether there's going to be any flexibility and interest in entertaining our concerns about limiting access. And we'll kind of take it up at that point. And decide, okay. And the board can then discuss, continue to pursue it, or take a different course of action. Okay, let's draw that to a close. So we'll take a break.